You are listening to the Sound Design Model 7620 cassette recorder.
Investigate the complete Victor Visible file and remove all of the present month's trace cards. This should be done the afternoon of the last day of the month or the...
The following is a special presentation made possible by a grant from the fine folks at D'Artagnan Petrochemicals, where the future was yesterday.
I'm Victoria Collins, and this is American Doom. Episode 2. How many Potters does it take to run the world? The initial rise of Pterodyne as a military contractor during World War II is well documented. But the origin of the Potter family is shrouded in secrecy. All we know is what was published in the 1973 historical fiction novel, An Evil from Athens, written by ex-Pterodyne insider Rudolfo Hamish, who, on his deathbed, admitted the story was as close to a Potter family history as anything. Even with names and locations changed, Pterodyne filed a defamation lawsuit for what they called an unauthorized biography by a disgruntled and deranged ex-employee. The book may have never seen the light of day if not for the intervention of D'Artagnan Petrochemicals and their massive stable of lawyers. Litigation dragged on for years, with Pterodyne unable to secure an injunction. The book was published and distributed all over the world. Eventually, the lawsuit was dropped when Pterodyne lost their lucrative US military contracts. The company pulled away from the public eye, and the Potters once again faded into history's memory.
Kenneth Potter here. Please make your way to the B-Wing, where we have an interactive exhibit waiting for your ankle biters. Educational and entertaining films, displays and experiments will keep them busy while you grab a libation in a working replica of the Tiki Tiger from the Wrench McTaggart Mysteries. Get your picture taken with a full-size likeness of the man himself. Sorry, blokes, no rum and tug rooms.
Well, it's false advertising if I don't tell them. I don't give a flying fuck what the lawyers said.
But where did the Potters come from? According to Pterodyne lawyers, the book's fictional Papathu family was a clear reference to the Potters, as they pointed out the striking similarities between the fact and fiction. Both families came from nothing and built successful companies, though the Potters have kept the details of their rise a closely guarded secret. While the real-life Potters claim their ancestry starts in the northern Germanic region of Europe, Hamish's Papathus, a stand-in for the Potters as Pterodyne lawyers allege, originated in Greece, where they were sailors throughout the 16th century. Christoph, the patriarch, built a thriving commercial fisherman business. By contrast, court records show the Potters built a powerful import-export business with no explanation of exactly what they were involved in. In the book, Christoph finds a strange rock while diving in the Adriatic Sea, and not long after, his wife, once thought to be barren, gives birth to triplets, Christoph Jr., Klaus, and Cato. The boys learn the family trade and take over when the elder Christoph dies at the age of 115. The unusually long succession of male descendants keeps the business going for centuries until Christoph III immigrates to America in the first wave of the late 1800s and changes his surname to Christoph Marder. Similarly, the real life Christopher Potter Jr. immigrated to the United Kingdom, where he was caught up in a smuggling scheme. He and his cohorts were shipped off to a penal colony in Australia around 1789. This is where the trail goes cold, until a Potter ancestor pops up in New York.
The pool rooms have been temporarily closed due to anomalies present after the most recent conflagration test. Be advised.
La nageio estas obstrucciita ie cindro por la abundo de du foia i malobservanto i post la giusa rondo de neado. Estu avertitai.
Hamish's fictional Christoph also makes his way to America when the mafia moves into his territory and threaten to eliminate his fishing company. With nothing but a knapsack of clothes and his great-grandfather's mystery rock, he quickly finds a place on the docks of New York City, where he adopts many side hustles. He begins slinging fish in the markets, plies his trade with ruthless efficiency, so ruthless he is given the nickname Dolophinia chapodi, or Murder Octopus, as his interests extend to so many schemes. One of these enterprises exposes German sympathizers, while a member of the American Protective League during World War I. He often reports innocent business rivals and has soon carved out a seafood import empire. Christoph Jr. and his wife Charlotte have a set of triplets, another similarity Terradyne's lawyers pointed out. In the book, Hamish asserts that the Marder boys are forced into ritual combat to decide who will take over the family business. Christoph Marder II rises victorious and spends the next few decades building his father's company into a force to be reckoned with. This success catches the eye of a government intelligence handler, and Christoph II is sent to Europe to secure scientists for the American war machine. Most he turns over to his handlers, but a few he keeps, and thus the seeds of Moderdyne, clearly a stand-in for Terradyne, are planted. While Terradyne was a military contractor, Moderdyne is an automat company, with restaurants all over Manhattan and the boroughs. This, however, was a front.
Recreation tapes have been distributed to your individual stations and residence pods. Ask your proctor for access codes and visualization implants for a more immersive experience.
Se vi ancora un estis approvita i poraperice camerao, vi devigere iro all'orientato, au altronto neado cae forgeso.
After Christoph Jr. passes, ironically from a tainted can of tuna, Christoph II secures several military contracts. By the time World War II kicks off, Moderdyne Secret Research makes it the most influential private American military provider in the country. Instructed to create a new front company to hide his work, Christoph reaches back into the past and remembers how fond his great-grandfather was of practical jokes. Marder Novelties appears as if overnight with a handful of offerings. The infamous whoopee cushion used in the actual assassination was changed to a deadly stick of chewing gum in the book. But it's all too clear what it represents. After the war, the assassination is exposed, and without government support, Marder's businesses quickly disappear and the automats are bought out. Most assume Christoph will be prosecuted, but he and his family flee to Greece, where the book ends, echoing the historic fall with no hint at their eventual ascendance. It would be 20 years before Kenwood Potter III rose to lead Terradyne back to prominence and secure his own frightening legacy.
A friendly reminder for new employment acquisitions during this time of orientation. Greet the light. Embrace Our Lady's infernal mercy.
Distrae surbendagioi estis distribuitai al viae individuae niveioi. Mal successo en rigardi cae recensi igios vin valida porneado.
It's all power, all pop, for the next three work cycles. Here's Gimmick, with a cover of The Chicken Won't Stop by The Holy Terrors, exclusively on...
Well, if the chicken won't stop, well, then what about the rapper's spin? How do I take most of the world? Like a promise that you've read, the chicken won't stop, the chicken won't stop.
The Wrench McTaggart Mysteries is an Applied Strategic Filmways production. Tonight's episode, Mephisto in Olive Drab. Once again, Wrench finds himself under suspicion for a crime he didn't commit. But the road of the wanderer in pursuit of justice is a lonely one. This is the domain of Wrench McTaggart. Patriot first, interstate trucker second, amateur detective by calling. And these, well, these are his adventures. When we last left our hero, Wrench was taint deep in the mysterious murder of Linda, Lady of the Road. But certain duties come first, like the care and maintenance of his big rig.
Looks good as new, Rudy. You'd never know I ran over that family of armadillos.
Right, Carl?
Ha! You always put a smile on my face with your keen sense of humor. Let's hit the road, pal, right after I finish cleaning her up.
I smell bacon.
McTaggart?
My friends call me Wrench.
Deputy Wilma Swift. Top of her class at Stanford. Quantico applicant. Washed out at NASA after a bad experience in the AC-30G. They called it air flight readiness. She knew it by its nickname, the Vomit Comet.
Hey, weren't you one of them ass cans?
It's ass cans, as in astronaut candidate.
I hear them spacesuits is heavy.
400 pounds of claustrophobia.
Been there. You ever had one ton Wanda sit on your face?
Right. Those fetish videos you were in, what were they called?
How did you?
I do my homework.
Well, I don't remember offhand.
The Smothers Brothers. You and that homunculus of a partner were into all types of sordid shit.
It was all harmless fun.
What's up with dudes into women popping balloons with their feet? Stomping is what they call it. That what you do to Linda? You get a little carried away, Wrench? What did Miss Laverty do to deserve such a despicable act?
Who?
Linda, the sex worker you brutally murdered in your hotel room.
I had nothing to do with that poor woman's demise. Just ask Rudy. He was there.
I'm not talking to a parrot.
Gracious!
If you're so sure, throw the cuffs on me.
You're lucky I don't. Seems you did a favor for the sheriff some time back and he owes you one.
Owes me a couple, but I don't keep score. Just a man's duty to a fellow lawman.
You're not a lawman.
This here badge says different.
Wrench's pride and joy. His real-life, genuine lawman badge. Tucked away in his diver-down Velcro wallet. Given to him by Sheriff Burroughs after a particularly nasty kidnapping case. But that's a story for another time.
Sheriff hands those out to the B-list celebrities and local business owners. Got a whole drawer full of them. I think he gave one to Shaquille O'Neal in 92. Used to pull people over and flash that hunk of plastic.
Listen, deputy, me and the sheriff have an understanding, okay? So why don't you...
When I mentioned the dead woman, you didn't even react.
Death haunts the endless blacktop. The specter of doom is a constant companion to a traveler of the white-lined python.
Yeah, we get it. You're one stoic son of a bitch. A regular Emmanuel cunt.
Huh?
Just be somewhere I can get a hold of you.
You betcha, deputy. I'll probably have this thing sewn up by the time you finish your next donut. You're welcome in advance.
Oh, right. I heard you fancy yourself some sort of private dick.
It's private investigator. And I've been known to employ the science of deductive inquiry.
A regular Hercule Poirot.
Like I said, Rudy's a macaw, not a parrot.
Jesus. Don't stray too far, like accidentally crossing the border into Mexico.
Wilma, come in, Deputy Wilma. There's a situation at the Tiki Tiger. Seems 8-Ball Teddy was a little handsy with that Filipino waitress, and she stabbed him in the scrotum with her butterfly knife.
I guess he's 1-Ball now.
Witness said it made a sound like an overripe avocado exploding in a microwave. Another swore it sounded more like popping a balloon of peaches and cream oatmeal. Or was it cinnamon and raisin? I'll check my notes.
Yep, got it.
Bartender said it was more like opening an expired can of fruit cocktail.
No need to go on.
The DJ said it was like a lawn dart hitting Rush Limbaugh's colostomy bag. Boy, howdy, can you even imagine?
I wish I hadn't.
Oh, boy. 8-Ball just sent me a photo from the ambulance. Shit. Looks like a rubber glove got snagged on a rusty nail and squirted Kool-Aid and Noxzema.
Roger that, Jesse. I'm on the way. Over and out. I'm keeping an eye on you.
A deputy's work is never done. Ever vigilant in the face of karmic genital mutilation. She speeds off to a wart on the seedy underbelly of the interstate, known as the Tiki Tiger. A den of horrors under giallo lights, served with a slice of pineapple and a hepatitis chaser, all set to the strains of Polynesian Muzak versions of 90s Lilith Fair bands.
Well, Rudy, looks like we got a hot case to solve. Business as usual, right, friend?
Greasy business.
Indeed. Let's saddle up.
Wrench returns to his natural habitat, the open road. It stretches before him like a white-lined python, never-ending, quiet, save for the soothing rumble of Firestone's finest on asphalt. But lo, what's this in the distance? A hitchhiker, begging thumb out, guitar slung across his back, army jacket over ripped jeans, like some sort of cosplayer on his way to a Billy Jack convention.
Danger!
Now, Rudy. Should we pick him up? Gets kind of lonely on the road, and you aren't the most verbose conversationalist. Gotta move you to the back seat, pal.
Your funeral.
Nothing like a good deed to balance the scales.
You're the first person I've seen in an hour. Much obliged.
Sure thing. Climb on in. That all you got with you?
That's all I need. Six strings and the truth, as someone said.
Well, I travel light myself. Just me and Rudy.
Nice to meet you, Rudy.
Trouble.
Pay no mind to him. He's an attention whore. What now? It's that crazy sumbitch again.
They're gonna hit us head on.
We've played this game before. I ain't moving this time.
I'm game.
That's the spirit. Come on now. Let's see what you got.
The demon car from hell stays on course. Nearer and nearer as Wrench girds his sinewy loins against what surely is going to be a spectacular collision. But at the last second, the car swerves out of the way, careens off the road into the scrub brush, swallowed by the darkness.
That was exhilarating. Someone got something against you?
No idea.
Got a quick peek at the woman behind the wheel. Platinum blonde hair. Kind of looked like Anna Nicole Smith, but a little more mannish, like a Kardashian.
You don't say.
Ex-wife.
So where are you headed?
Back to Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah? Where are you coming from?
Little town in Texas called Rembrandt. Ever heard of it?
Can't say as I have. You run into something or from something?
Both, I guess. Got a little tired of the quiet life. Need some neon in my eyes. Warm skin under my fingertips. Music in my ears.
I hear you. Well, why don't you play us a tune while we travel?
Sure thing. Thank you.
the case take our hero? Who's the woman in the car? Who's this mystery man with the angelic voice? And what exactly happened back in Texas? Be careful, Wrench. Rudy smells...
Danger!
Letter B. Banquet space reservations must include sufficient setup and breakdown time. Example. Do not book a meeting in a particular room from 8 to 12 and a 12 o'clock luncheon in the same room.
From the depths of the outer dark come tales to bewilder, befuddle, and bemuse. Tales to surely disconcert even the most ardent traveler through static negation. They can only be Tales from Pterodyne.
Beginning descent, Mission Control.
Steady there, Prometheus. Try to find a particularly dark sunspot to land on. It's cooler there. It'll be easier for the solar module to maintain its structural integrity.
Way ahead of you. Already got one lined up, Mission Control. Landing in T-minus 15 seconds. Mission Control, the Sunbird has landed.
Congratulations. You, Colonel Harrison Baumgartner, will go down in history as the first person to land on the sun.
Thanks, Mission Control. It's an incredible honor. Preparing to exit the solar module.
Excellent. Now, let's go through the checklist. Triple insulated pressure suit.
Check.
Fully charged oxygen pack.
Check.
Wraparound UV sunglasses.
Check. Oh, wait a minute, Mission Control. I'm noticing that these sunglasses just say polarized on them. No mention of UV protection.
Damn it. When we sent that stupid intern to Target, we specifically told him to make absolutely sure to get UV sunglasses. Well, you can use the polarized sunglasses, but you're going to have to squint.
No problem, Mission Control. I went through over 200 hours of squint training for just such an eventuality as this. Anyway, I'm all set now. Popping the pressurized bolts and opening the hatch. Woo-wee! Sure is bright out there.
Remember your training, Harrison. Be sure to maintain a perfectly calibrated 2.75 millimeter wide squint at all times to mitigate the risk of retinal damage.
Got it covered, Mission Control. I'm descending the ladder now. As my namesake once sang, here comes the sun, doo-doo-doo-doo. Here comes the sun, and I say, it's all right.
It is indeed all right, Colonel Baumgartner. It is indeed all right. So, getting the camera powered up? The people of Earth eagerly await the first close-up view of the solar landscape.
It's on, but just getting warmed up, so to speak.
Okay, good. Your video signal should reach Earth in a few minutes. Until then, you'll have to describe for us what you're seeing.
There's not a lot to describe from where I'm standing. It's pretty desolate and bright. Very, very bright.
No surprise there, Colonel Baumgartner.
Well, the solar module has automatically ejected the solar roving vehicle, so I'm thinking it's time for a little sightseeing ride.
Absolutely.
Here I go. Okay, moving along here at approximately 8 miles per hour. Nice smooth ride. Whoa! Seeing some solar flares in the distance, like giant glowing whips unfurling into the blackness of space.
Wow. Sounds magnificent.
Hang on. There's something in the near distance on my right. Turning in that direction now. Good golly, Miss Molly. It appears to be a large structure of some kind.
An artificial structure? Does this mean...
intelligent life on the sun? Incredibly enough? Yes, Mission Control, that's exactly what it means. In fact, as I'm drawing closer, I can now see that there is a group of beings gathered outside a gray, metallic, dome-shaped building. They're looking in my direction and appear to be awaiting my arrival.
Be careful, Harrison. We know nothing about these creatures. They could be dangerous.
Getting closer now. There are five entities. They appear to be females. In fact, they are much like human women.
Incredible. And how would you describe these solar females?
Well, Mission Control, I'd have to say they're pretty hot.
Ha! Well, I guess of necessity, solar women.
This dramatic television presentation has been terminated due to its breach of classified technological research. All writers, cast, crew, and post-production personnel will report immediately to Bay 45 for mandatory static negation.
Now, you may have heard some rumblings about something called static negation. The eggheads here at Pterodyne R&D assure me that it's all business as usual, so just ignore the goss. There's nothing to be afraid of. They say it even tickles a bit. So, take it from me, Kenneth Potter, step right up and show your loyalty to your brothers and sisters. They're all working hard to keep everyone safe and sound.
Well, if you dickheads keep your mouth shut, no one will find out now, will they? Keep the bloody John Dory to yourselves.
Untitled Whatever, Episode 2.
Nice place you got here, Mrs. Boyce.
Now, Mr.
Wampum, Mrs. Boyce.
The toolbox, Mr. Wampum. I would ask you to remove it from my clean kitchen table, please.
Of course. Sorry, ma'am. So, you said you had a problem with the ventilation in your basement?
Indeed, Mr. Wampum.
You can call me Torp, ma'am.
I will not. It's even more ridiculous than your last name.
It's Tenekowan, ma'am.
And what might that be?
The tribe I'm descended from on my dad's side. All but forgotten. They were at the Battle of Little Bighorn, a small portion among the many tribes that fought that day. My great-great-great-grandmother put the arrow up Custer's urethra.
Oh, Mr. Wampum, how revolting.
You have a beautiful home. I bet you make a lot of money. In fact, I bet I could guess exactly how much this place cost, right down to the carpet.
My husband does all right.
I'm sure he does.
Mr. Wampum, I'd rather you not enter the living room with those work boots on.
You want I should take them off?
No. I'd rather you...
Well, look at this. This is what you call a regular objet d'art, eh?
Unhand that, Mr. Wampum!
What is it? Some kind of fancy ashtray from Sharper Image?
Certainly not. This is an urn, Mr. Wampum.
Anyone I know?
My late sister, if you must know.
You got a lot of pictures on the mantelpiece here. Is this one her?
Yes, actually. Oh, must you pick it up, Mr. Wampum? Your fingers appear grimy.
Must have been summer when this was taken, judging by the shorts and bikini top. She was very lovely, ma'am. What a waste.
Please put the photo down. Thank you. But now you're manhandling the urn again. Sir, I would ask you not to lift the lid and hold it under your nose.
A goddamn waste, if you ask me. Welp, show me to the basement. No point in lollygagging.
Finally, it's through the kitchen, Mr. Wampum, as I showed you earlier.
You hang tight up there, Mrs. Boyce. Shouldn't take me long. Not long at all.
Join us next time for Episode 3 of Untitled Whatever.
Quick question.
You are standing outside a burning building. There's only enough time to run in and save either a dozen babies or the American Doom podcast. Which would you choose?
American Doom, of course. There's not a single baby, child, or full-grown person on this planet whose life is worth 1/1,000,000,000 of what American Doom is worth. Kill them. Kill them all.
Thank you very much.
You're tuned in to Terradyne's 10,000-watt giant. Giant.
Twitchy little nose, tiny powder puff tail. They plan to rule the world, and you know they won't fail. 'Cause no one would suspect these furry rodents from hell. If the rabbit hutch could speak, oh, what stories it would tell. Big fluffy bunnies, evil twinkle in their eyes. Karen nine bastards, Satan's helpers in disguise. Big fluffy bunnies, give them credit for their guile. Little fascist fuckers, Peter Avick, Sieg Heil.
The Chicken Won't Stop was written by Rob Elba.
American Doom is produced and written by J. Philip Wilkins and Gary Messick. D'Artagnan Petrochemicals thanks you for your time and attention.